Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, and the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. Mr. Fitzpatrick, do you have a motion?
I do, Your Honor.
Or more than one?
One motion and a lot of requests at the end. If you would come up. Your Honors, I'm pleased to be here this morning to move the admission of a number of the law clerks and staff attorneys for the Court of Appeals. The first is Matthew Burke, who is a law clerk to you, Chief Judge Flum. He received his undergraduate degree from the University of Virginia, his law school degree from Northwestern, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Sterling Darling is a staff attorney with the court, received his undergraduate degree from Harvard, and his law school degree is from Georgetown, and he's admitted to practice in the states of Massachusetts and New York. Leslie Farby is a law clerk to Chief Judge Flum, received her undergraduate at Yale and her law school degree from New York University, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. James Hendrickson received his undergraduate degree from St. John's University, did graduate work at the University of Chicago, and then got his law degree from the University of Michigan, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and is a law clerk for Circuit Judge Bauer. Mark Kashner received his undergraduate degree from the University of California at Los Angeles, his law degree from the University of Southern California, and is admitted to practice in the state of California, and is a staff attorney with the Court of Appeals. Christy Mace received her undergraduate degree from Oberlin College, and her law school degree is from Northwestern, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and is a clerk for Chief Judge Flum. Matt Madden received his undergraduate degree from Notre Dame, and is a law degree from the University of Illinois, and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois, and is a clerk for Circuit Judge Bauer. Kenneth McRoberts received his undergraduate degree from Trinity University, and his law school degree is from Harvard, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Texas, and is a staff attorney with the court. Michael O'Donnell received his undergraduate degree from Indiana University, his law school degree is from Boston College. He's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois and is a staff attorney with the court, and I hope we see all nine of them in the future before this court, maybe taking appointments to the court, but that's a separate part, not part of my motion. That's just an editorial comment.
All right. Well, we appreciate that. You were unable to come up with a holder of a Marquette degree?
But there's a change. I was here 2 days ago, and everyone was from University of Chicago, so there is a little diversity before today in this group.
All right. Well, I'll check with my panel members, because it would be nice if it was unanimous, the granting of the motion. And I'm assuming that Judge Bauer and I will not recuse based on
sponsorship or anything else. Yeah.
Several of the applicants. But I indeed obviously know the candidates, and I know, as you've related their background, they're well-educated and have contributed mightily this year to the work of the court.
And we expect them to continue doing the same thing.
Well, that's part of Collins' suggestion that they be active and stay connected to the court, and we hope they have that opportunity for those who practice in the area. And I'm assuming, Judge Evans, despite the absence of any Marquette candidates, you're comfortable granting the motion.
I'm comfortable with all right. Nine.
Judge Bauer?
Same way.
All right. Then, hearing no objection from colleagues, indeed concurrence, and in my view having been already expressed, the motion is granted, and we wish you all a great continued success. Obviously, you've had success in your young careers to date, and if you'll approach the clerk's area and you take the oath, I will, at this point, in advance of your taking it, wish you a long and successful tenure as members of the Bar of the Court.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The first case that was scheduled for argument was Statton versus Nissan. Mr. Phoenix, it appears that the attorney for the appellant has not arrived. We will call the second case, and as soon as he arrives, we will return to that case. So we will pass the first case at this point and go to the second case for argument. Central States versus Shelly Corporation. Mr. Lee.
Please, the court. My name is Charles Lee, and I represent Central States Pension Fund. Truck Transport and Local 878 were parties to a collective bargaining agreement and participation agreement, which required Truck Transport to remit pension contributions to Central States. Truck Transport's employees voted to decertify Local 878, and the NLRB certified the results of the decertification election on November 21, 1997. After the decertification, Truck Transport continued to make contributions to Central States until January of 1998. The issue that's before this court is whether under ERISA, an employer's obligation to contribute to a multi-employer plan immediately terminates upon the decertification of a local union. All the circuit courts that have addressed this issue have said yes. However, the arbitrator and district court in the proceedings below disagreed and held that Truck Transport had a duty to contribute post-decertification. Now, the fact that the arbitrator and district court ignored the decisions of the circuit courts was surprising. But what made the decisions more even surprising and quite honestly confusing was how they reached their decisions. First, both the arbitrator and district court concluded that Local 878's decertification terminated the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, and any obligation to contribute under that agreement. However, both concluded that the participation agreement survived the decertification, and that under that agreement, Truck Transport had a continuing duty to contribute. Now, what is confusing about this matter is that there's no reasonable basis to conclude that one agreement terminated upon decertification while the other did not. First, the participation agreement, like the collective bargaining agreement, is an agreement solely between Truck Transport and Local 878. Central States is not a party to either agreement. In fact, this court looked in Central States versus Gerber at this, looked to the status of Central States with respect to these collective bargaining agreements and participation agreements, and concluded that Central States was merely third party. So since the same parties were involved in both agreements, the arbitrator and district court could not have relied on this factor to distinguish the two agreements. Now, Shilley will attempt to justify the decisions by arguing that the participation agreement survived because Truck Transport failed to comply with a provision in the agreement which required the employer, here Truck Transport, to notify Central States by certified mail that it was no longer required to make contributions. However, we would submit that this cannot be the basis for the two decisions. The collective bargaining agreement, like the participation agreement, also contained a written notice provision regarding termination. After the decertification, Truck Transport did not notify Local 878 saying that they were going to terminate this collective bargaining agreement. Yet Shilley the arbitrator and the district court would all agree that the collective bargaining agreement terminated upon Local 870 certification, regardless of the notice provision. Now, Shilley will also probably argue that the two arguments are somehow different from one another, but this is wrong. They're both collective bargaining agreements in that both are agreements between Truck Transport, the employer, and Local 878 regarding the terms and conditions of employment. It just so happens that the participation agreement is limited to fringe benefit contributions. Now, when you take into consideration, one, that the two same parties were involved in both agreements, two, that both agreements had written notice provisions regarding termination, and three, that both were collective bargaining agreements, we would submit that there was no reasonable basis to conclude that, again, that one agreement terminated upon Local 878's decertification while the other did not. The second part of the arbitrator and district court's decision was even more confusing. After they concluded that the participation agreement survived the decertification, both accepted Shilley's argument that the participation agreement was an enforceable agreement under ERISA 29 U.S.C. Section 1145. Now, the circuit courts that have interpreted this section have interpreted it as precluding employers from raising a variety of defenses as a means of avoiding the obligation to contribute to a multi-employer plan. However, one of the few defenses, actually one of the three defenses that have been recognized by the courts is the decertification of a union. In other words, if a multi-employer plan sues under Section 1145 to collect contributions, the circuit courts have held that the employer can justify its refusal to pay contributions by asserting that the bargaining representative was decertified. Now, if you apply that law to the facts of this case, Central States could not have enforced Truck Transport's obligation to contribute after the decertification. Because Truck Transport could simply say, well, Local 878 was decertified, so we really don't have any more obligation to contribute. So it would seem logical to conclude that Truck Transport did not have an obligation to contribute, regardless of whether the participation agreement survived or not. However, that's not what the arbitrator and district court held. Both agreed with Shilley and concluded that the participation agreement was an enforceable agreement under Section 1145. Nonetheless, they concluded, contrary to the decisions of the circuit courts, that Local 878's decertification had really no effect on Truck Transport's obligation to contribute under the participation agreement. And basically, what we submit is that they essentially held that the participation agreement was not subject to Section 1145's defenses. We would submit that the decisions are illogical and contrary to applicable case law. If, as the arbitrator and district court in Chile argued, the participation agreement is an enforceable agreement under 1145, then it would seem that it must also be subject to its defenses, including the defense of the certification. Assuming that the participation agreement did not terminate upon the decertification, we would also argue that Truck Transport's failure to comply with the written notice requirement under the participation agreement did not continue its obligation to contribute. The notice requirement was a condition precedent that's contained in the participation agreement to protect Central States. And as such, it could have been waived and really was waived here by Central States' actions. Throughout the arbitration and district court, we've never asked for Truck Transport to give us a written notice. In fact, we've always maintained that Truck Transport's obligation to contribute terminated upon the decertification. So regardless of whether Truck Transport complied with the notice requirement, Central States waived it. So they can't use it as some sort of shield and say, we never gave you the notice, Central States, so we still had an obligation to contribute. Additionally, it's basic contract law that a party who prevents or interferes with the occurrence of a condition precedent to a contract cannot take advantage of that non-occurrence and claim that they're not liable. Here, Truck Transport's obligation to contribute terminated. Only Truck Transport had the power to submit that notice to Central States.
Can you tell me, is there a situation that could arise where it would be in the interests of Central State to argue that the participation agreement is a separate enforceable agreement after a union has been decertified? It might be in your financial interest to take the other side.
Financial interest?
Yeah.
It's hard to say. Obviously, Mr. Hansen will come up here and say that's kind of what happened here, is that if we tried to collect contributions, the 1997 partial withdrawal was more than what it would have been in 1998. It's possible that Central States could assert that the obligation to contribute continued, and it might be better for them financially if, for example, the withdrawal would be higher in the following year. But at the same time, you really don't know. You would have to look into a lot of factors. One is what effect it would have on an employee's pension credit. For example, would it give them, would it bump up their benefits if we continued, if the employer was required to continue contributions up to the next year? So you would kind of have to look into a variety of factors for that. But we would submit that, you know, basically the law is that after a union has been decertified, contributions really aren't owed. And the reasoning set forth is that is was set forth in West Coast Sheet Metal, the Ninth Circuit opinion that we cited in our briefs, is that the union and the employer enter agreement to make contributions for the employees that are represented by the union to a trust fund. If the union is decertified, there really makes no sense to require contributions on behalf of those employees. And that's basically the same rationale that applies to this case. You know, we're Central States is a multi-employer fund. It's a Taft-Hartley fund. The employees, the participants in Central States are union represented. To require contributions for someone that's not represented just really doesn't make any sense. I see that my light is on, so I'd like to reserve the rest of the time if you have no more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Hansen.
Thank you. May it please the court. The decision of the district court in this case, which affirmed the arbitrator's decision on identical grounds, should be affirmed for two reasons. The first is the participation agreement is an independent enforceable agreement, or agreement enforceable by Central States, until it is terminated in accordance with the terms of the notice provisions included in that participation agreement. The second reason is that the monthly certification clause, which was signed by Truck Transport after the decertification, becomes a new obligation, a new contractual obligation, affirming that obligation to contribute for those employees in those months for which contributions are submitted, which were after the decertification. That is just as Central States has argued in other cases, the same effect. Before addressing those two, I do want to answer the one question that you raised, Judge Evans, about the financial benefit to the funds. If you had a situation where an employer was participating in a multi-employer fund for less than 5 years, if they withdraw, there is no withdrawal liability. It would behoove Central States in that case to argue that because of a decertification, there's no obligation to contribute, but they have the participation agreement signed, they could collect contributions in lieu of getting any withdrawal liability. There are circumstances with other types of facts in which that can happen. The thing that Mr. Lee said about looking at a variety of factors, what employees have in terms of vested benefits does not make a difference on the amount of withdrawal liability. Going from one year to the next because of contributions doesn't matter. You pay a pro rata share of your total contributions versus the total employer contributions. You create a fraction and multiply that by the amount of unfunded vested benefits to come out what your withdrawal liability is. It has nothing to do with the amount that a person may get because they bump up into the next level of benefits because they've been contributing. It's simply based on your contribution history as a whole versus all employers as a whole. Now, on the participation agreement, it's enforceable by central states, even though in the cases of held, Marine's the primary one, the union no longer represents the employees, the employer has no duty to recognize or bargain with the union, and there's no collective bargaining agreement. Central States has time and time again used collective bargaining or used a participation agreement to collect contributions just as they could have in this case. And that is until the participation agreement by its terms is terminated. Now, it's not a collective bargaining agreement. That document is created by Central States. It's on its letterhead. Central States is the only name that is mentioned seven different times in that document. It is their created document. It is unnecessary in the sense of we have a collective bargaining agreement that creates an obligation to contribute to the pension fund. We don't need a participation agreement as another collective bargaining agreement to do the same thing. Rather, it provides certain benefits to Central States, and it accepts that. The employer is not allowed to participate, as the participation agreement says in the last paragraph, until the fund accepts the participation. They have to approve it before that agreement is in effect. They are a third-party beneficiary, and they get certain benefits, including the notice provision. Now, that notice provision under a collective bargaining agreement is a notice by one of the party, the union or the employer, to provide notice to the other of cancellation. The participation agreement is completely different, and there's a policy reason behind that. It requires notice not from the employer to the union or the union to the employer. It requires the employer to give notice to Central States, and it has to state, when it gives the notice, its legal reason for it not having an obligation to contribute. And it is only effective once Central States acknowledges that notice. It provides much more of a benefit to Central States.
What does that mean? Acknowledges the notice.
That's what Central States, in my opinion, it's an acknowledgement. They receive it and they acknowledge that that's a valid legal reason. They would have the ability, if we quit making contributions, to go to court and say you didn't have a valid legal reason. Now,
did
in the
Chile
case,
ever give notification?
I'm sorry.
Did Chile ever give notification to Central States?
It did not provide a formal written notification until sometime later during the litigation. Central States found out about the decertification, as Central States says in its brief, about 2 months after the decertification, when they began making inquiry into why weren't contributions being made.
Mm-hmm. What's the strict compliance with the terms call for?
It calls for the employer. In this case, the employer should have given notice. Absolutely. Now, did Central States waive that? You know, they claim they waived that notice provision. But the interesting thing is, by their actions, they say, but they never refunded the payments. They said, well, you can apply for the payments if you want them back. But if they were really waiving the notice provision and they said you shouldn't have made the contributions, they should have turned around and written a check to refund the contributions if they were exhibiting an intent to waive the notice provision. And they didn't do that in this case. There's no evidence to support any waiver. Now, the monthly certification clause is Central States has argued in primarily three different cases that are the key ones, the Joseph McClellan case, the Kappas case, and the Marine case, that the monthly certification clause creates a separate legal agreement, contractual agreement, to make contributions for the month in which the contributions are being made. And it's not, you know, Central States says, well, that's illegal. You can't do that. And I don't know of any. There's never any explanation, never any cite to a case or a specific statute that says why it's illegal to make contributions. Central States certainly collects, as we've shown, as an example, the Marine case, that they continue to collect, even seek 1145 actions to collect contributions from employers when the employees aren't represented by the union. The employer has no duty to recognize or bargain with the union, and there's no collective bargaining agreement. They use the certification clause in Joseph McClellan case, and they've used it in Marine and also in CAPIS as an additional contractual reason why they're entitled to contributions when employees are working. And in this case, the employees continue to work through the first third of the month of January of 1998. The obligation to contribute can exist even after the termination of the agreement, the termination of the representation of the union, and the duty to bargain or to recognize and bargain. There's certain comments made about why we didn't do this, that somehow the employer can control and manipulate when its withdrawal liability occurs. I tell you, I hear that, and I still can't believe that type of an argument. The employer does not have the financial information to be able to determine in December of a particular year what the withdrawal liability will be if it withdraws in this year, let alone the next year that has not even occurred. We don't know what the stock market's going to do, what the contributions are going to be of all employers, how they're going to do in terms of the number of retirees they have. It's pure speculation to say that the employer manipulates. Plus, Central States has a weapon under MEPA that if any employer does something to evade or avoid withdrawal liability, it can take action to set that aside. And it could have done that if it believed that there was some type of manipulation done by the employer to evade or avoid withdrawal liability. And it took no such action because I don't believe it really believes that we manipulated, that we had any information or knowledge to be able to do it. As the arbitrator specifically found, it was probably due to inadvertence or some type of negligence in administration of the contract or the relationship between Central States and the employer and nothing more. You know, Central States only wins if the participation agreement is considered a collective bargaining agreement. And the case law is clear, and Central States has gone to great lengths through the years to establish that a participation agreement is separate and independent of a collective bargaining agreement. The cases that Central States relies on, primarily the sheet metal workers versus West Coast sheet metal case, specifically contemplates that there can be agreements that would obligate an employer to contribute even though there's been a decertification and a termination of the collective bargaining agreement. The court in that case out of the Ninth Circuit said that it did not find any other type of agreement that survived beyond the collective bargaining. There were none. The trust agreement wasn't provided. There was another case that's cited by Central States International Paper. And in International Paper, the agreement was a recall agreement, and the court said that wasn't one that survived decertification. That was one that had nothing to do with pension fund obligations. It is a situation in which the cases they rely on specifically say there can be other agreements that survive decertification and that can continue the obligation to contribute. Central States has gone to great lengths through the years in the cases that have been cited to show that a participation agreement is a separate and independent agreement. And I read back through their memorandum that they submitted. We attached it as I believe it's Appendix C of our supplemental appendix. Their memorandum that they submitted to the district court in the Marine case. And it's interesting because everything that they argued in Marine is exactly opposite to what they're arguing in this case. Their position on what the participation agreement stands for, what it does, how it operates, is directly contrary to what they said in Marine. They said in Marine that the termination provision becomes meaningless if it doesn't survive beyond the collective bargaining agreement. And that is exactly the case. That's in fact what it does, is that until the employer provides notice and the union or the pension fund, central states, acknowledges it, it continues, the obligation continues.
Do those cases involve the certification of a union that you speak of?
Yes, they did. And they looked at whether any agreements extended beyond the collective bargaining agreement. And they just simply said there can be, we just didn't find one in this case. And they didn't consider participation agreements. The arbitrator said that, and I believe the district court also said it, but the arbitrator very clearly said that those cases never had a participation agreement discussing whether it continued to exist. If there's no other questions, I'm through. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hanson. Mr. Lee.
Could I just go back to Judge Evans' question regarding whether it would be in central state's interest to pursue contributions after decertification? I was thinking about that a little bit more, and admittedly, yeah, it might be in certain instances. But the point is that the law is written such that we can't. The law says that if there's a decertification, you can't collect contributions. That's the defense under Section 1145. So even if we wanted to collect contributions after a decertification, we couldn't. I want to touch on the Marine case that Mr. Hanson was referring to. That was the case that the district court and the arbitrator relied primarily on in reaching their decisions. Marine did not involve decertification. It was a case where central states sought to collect contributions after the termination of a collective bargaining agreement, and after the NLRB had determined that the employer didn't have a duty to bargain anymore. Now, what Marine involved was the one-person bargaining unit rule. And that rule, I guess, if you will, is different from decertification. And there's two reasons for why it's different. First, the union's representation does not terminate as a result of the one-person rule. In fact, the NLRB has held quite frequently that a union can lawfully represent a one-person bargaining unit. And additionally, nothing in the NLRA prohibits an employer from recognizing and bargaining with a union that consists of one, with a unit that consists of one employee. So the union's representation in Marine didn't necessarily terminate. In contrast, in this case, the union was decertified, so the union's representation terminated immediately. Moreover, the employer, Truck Transport, couldn't bargain with the Local 878 anymore because that would be illegal. And second, and more importantly, is that this court in Martin versus Garmin Construction held that the one-person rule was not a defense to a collection action under Section 1145. And we rely heavily on that case in our briefs, whereas the circuit courts have unanimously held that decertification is a defense under Section 1145. So we would submit that Marine is an opposite to this case. With respect to the refund of the payments, they made $770 in contributions for that period after decertification. During the arbitration, after we concluded that they really didn't have an obligation to remit those contributions, we offered to refund them back. And we said, if you want it back, just let us know. They never responded. And obviously, we could have just said, here, take these back, but they probably would have just returned it back to us. So there was no point in that. See, the red light's on, so there's no other questions. We would just ask that the court reverse the decision of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Has Mr. Giganti arrived? All right. We will call the first case now.